News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9 KMJ. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity. And along the way, be inspired as we learn about how much they love their country. And this week, before we get to a World War II veteran, we're going to talk to someone a lot younger. And a lot of times you've heard the guests on this program say that they wish young people knew more about World War II. Well, we're going to meet one young man who has learned a thing or two about World War II, including America's first days of that war. 15-year-old Noah Barnes of Boise, Idaho, joins me now. And Noah, we're standing near this monument that a lot of people have been coming to see in Veterans Memorial Park here in Boise. What's that monument all about?
It's really just about explaining and teaching about the story of Wake Island during World War II that most people haven't even heard about and don't even know what Wake Island is.
And what was the first thing you ever heard about Wake Island?
The first time I heard about it was when my mom and grandparents told me about my great-grandfather dying, getting captured and taken to a prisoner of war camp.
How old were you at the time, you think?
Oh, I can't remember. I was pretty young.
But you thought, wow, that's a pretty intriguing part of family history there, huh?
Yeah.
So you learned this legacy of your grandfather, and he was not there as part of the U.S. military. Tell me what he was doing there on Wake Island.
There was a company here named Morrison Knutson who hired for construction work, and a lot of people from Boise signed up to go build a landing strip on Wake Island for planes to refuel because it was way out there. And so he took the job, and they didn't expect to be caught up in a war, but that's what happened.
So now you've learned a thing or two about Wake Island, and you've learned about people like your great-grandfather who weren't even in the military, but they ended up fighting the Japanese on Wake Island. When did you decide that there needed to be a monument here in Boise to honor guys like your great-grandfather?
When I was deciding what project I was going to do for my Eagle Scout project, I wanted to do something a lot bigger than building birdhouses or painting a church or something. And I remembered about that story and decided to research it to see if there are any monuments here, and there weren't, so that's what I wanted to do.
So how do you go about doing that? I mean, this sounds like an awfully big project for, I guess when you started this, you're what, 13 maybe?
Yeah, it took about 2 years. It took a lot of work and had to contact a lot of people, but it really paid off.
Well, big time. And if you go to KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can see a picture of this monument here in Boise and see a picture of Noah Barnes, the young man who got the ball rolling to have this here now. So you learned a little bit about your great-grandfather, but what was it like when you started talking to some of the survivors who were still around from Wake Island that were there with Morrison Knutson on Wake Island and were here in Boise to talk about it? That must have been pretty neat for you.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible to talk to them one-on-one and have them tell their stories, and it was really neat.
So what all went into making this happen? I know you want to get that Eagle Scout, and I'm sure it's going to happen for you, but what did it take to raise the money, the materials, and to actually see this become a reality on this past Pearl Harbor Day?
I had to go and contact a lot of people and ask them for donations, such as Mesa Tile and Stone donated the black granite, and Gerhard Barbonis donated the sandstone. And I also have members of my family that run the business Stone Creations, and they create monuments, and they donated basically all of their time and work for my project.
So when you started, I bet you thought, you know, this is a big dream. I don't know if this is going to happen, but it must have been encouraging as the process went forward to see how much people wanted to help you, huh?
Yeah, I didn't even know if it was going to be possible, but once I found all these people that wanted to really pitch in and help, it went really fast.
So on Pearl Harbor Day, you're out here, the TV stations are out here, the newspaper's out here, and what, five or six Wake Island survivors were here?
Yeah.
What was that day like for you?
Oh, it was really big, and a lot more people showed up than we expected, and it was really incredible.
What are you going to do now that you're done with this? Because, I mean, all this hard work over a couple years has paid off. You finally have the memorial here. Guys like your great-grandfather won't be forgotten, but you probably feel energized to do something else, huh?
Yeah, I don't know yet.
for our listeners, and we'll talk to a Wake Island survivor here in a little bit, but for our listeners who maybe don't know the story of Wake Island, and it's certainly not as famous as what happened on Oahu that day at Pearl Harbor, what's your understanding? What have you learned about the history there? And what makes you so proud of your great-grandfather?
I learned that very many civilians went to that island expecting to earn some easy money, but they ended up fighting a war, and it was just an incredible story, and I learned a lot.
What was maybe the aspect of the story that struck you the most, and that if you try to put yourself in their shoes, what's the hardest for you to imagine?
Just how long they held off the Japanese, and they even sunk at least one ship or two. They just held them off for so long on the tiny islands, completely surrounded.
And a lot of these, I mean, there were some military personnel there, but how many of these civilians were there fighting?
I can't remember.
So according to your monument here, it says 449 Marines, 68 sailors, 6 Army Air Corps, and 1,146 civilians employed by Boise-based Morrison Knudsen Company were on the island. 250 of those Morrison Knudsen workers were from the state of Idaho originally, and for 15 days, they fought the Japanese. Can you imagine doing that if you'd never had any military training?
I could not imagine that.
What has the response been from your family with everything that you've done here to know that this monument is here now?
They can't thank me enough.
Is there one thing that someone said to you or that you've experienced in this whole process that maybe is the most meaningful thing to you?
Just how much everyone I've met has thanked me and congratulated me and told me their stories. And
what about your friends at school? What have they said about it?
Oh, they thought it was really cool, and yeah.
Do you think anybody at your school knew what Wake Island was and what had happened there?
Most of them haven't heard about that at all.
Tell me about Joe, the gentleman that I'm going to talk to here in a little bit, because you've talked to him. You've heard his story, and I understand he tells it pretty well. Is there any part of what he shared that just really resonated with you?
Just imagining my grandpa there and being with him, and it's just really neat to think about. And
have you thought about maybe making it to Wake Island someday yourself?
I hope to, yeah. Hope to see what it looks like there and how big it is.
Anything else that you want to share with our listeners or even people your age that maybe they have an idea like this and they don't think it's possible?
If you ever have any idea on something you want to do but you think it's could be too big, it's definitely not, and there's always a way to get it done.
You know, like I said earlier, a lot of the guys that I interview, they think that young people today don't know anything about World War II. They don't get taught anything about it in school. Obviously, you've learned a thing or two. So in your understanding, why does World War II matter today? Why should it mean anything to us at all in today's world?
Because so many Americans died for us today, and we might not even be here if it wasn't for them right now.
Well said. Anything else that you want to say about your memorial and your whole process of putting it together?
It was well worth it.
Amen. Well, Noah, congratulations. Thanks for what you've done, and keep doing it, all right?
Yep.
That is 15-year-old Noah Barnes of Boise, Idaho. I want to thank his school, Bishop Kelly High School, for putting me in touch with his parents, who facilitated our interview. I've got a link to Noah's Remember Wake Island blog at kmjnow.com, where you can see pictures of this terrific memorial. If you are listening to the radio on Christmas Eve 70 years ago today, you might have heard this.
The Navy announces that Wake Island is probably captured by the enemy, and now it is disclosed that fewer than 400 Marines held Wake Island for at least 14 days against heavy Japanese attack. The Marines had 12 fighter planes and a small quantity of weapons. They were commanded by a 38-year-old Marine Major, James P.S. Devereaux. They sank one Japanese light cruiser and 3 destroyers. They held out against 13 raids.
No mention in that 1941 report of all the civilians who were also there fiercely and courageously fighting against the enemy, but you're going to hear from one of them next. For the rest of the program today, we're going to hear 90-year-old ex-prisoner of war Joe Goicoechea's story. Hometown Heroes is coming right back here on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school.
Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We have heard from 15-year-old Noah Barnes about his project in Boise, Idaho, and the memorial that now stands in the Veterans Memorial Park there, honoring the survivors of Wake Island, including more than 1,100 civilian personnel that were contracted by Morrison Knutson Company of Boise, Idaho, to go build facilities on Wake Island. We're going to meet one of them now. 90-year-old Joe Goikuchea of Boise came over. Your parents came over from the Basque area between France and Spain. So you have this Basque heritage, and you're in Boise, Idaho, working for a company called Morrison Knutson. They say, we want you to go to the Pacific. Is that how it came about?
They couldn't find people to go. They'd go and they'd come back and see Wake Island's right in the middle of nowhere. And they'd go, so hell, I was only 19, and I figured I'd go there and become a millionaire working because they needed men so bad. And I went there with my buddies, and I really enjoyed it. I learned a trade there, and I worked the rest of my life as a structural steel iron worker, and I got along good with everybody.
You went over to Wake Island in July of 1941, and as you said, it truly was the middle of nowhere. I mean, there's nothing anywhere close to Wake Island, right?
No, there's Midway Island between there and Honolulu, and then Johnson Island the other way, and then, of course, you got Guam and Philippines.
But the reason that they needed people to go to Wake Island was to build structures that were going to be used by the military. So did that give you a clue that war was coming?
We knew pretty well what was going. Even on the troop ship we went on, we were zigzagging the night, and the smoking lamp was out. Nobody could smoke at night. They used us guys carrying ammunition, practice 5-inch ammunition to the guns, and then we'd take them back. And they knew something was going to happen. We didn't. We just thought we could kick their butt in a hurry, you know. But
and you had had zero military training, right?
ROTC. I was a lieutenant high school. And then when I was 16, I forged my dad's name and joined the 116th Cavalry, National Guard. And I was in the National Guard.
So you were familiar with some military practices, but you weren't part of the U.S. military. You're just a civilian out in the Pacific.
But when I come back and I got a discharge from the Navy, see?
Well, we're going to hear the story about how all that happened. So before we get to December of 41, tell me the kinds of things you were doing on Wake Island. What kinds of structures were you building and why?
Well, we were building the officers' barracks and then a big hospital and enlisted man's barracks. The officers were built on Wake Island, and the others were built on Peel Island. Gosh, we had about everything going on, and for seaplanes to land, and oil reserves, gasoline reserves, about everything. We had people come that were old, come from the Golden Gate Bridge, who worked on that, and the Hoover Dam, the Holland Tunnel in New York. They're the ones that taught me the trade. They were about my dad's age. So they were in their 40s and 50s. They spent quite a bit of time teaching me and everything, and I'd ask a lot of questions. Then the night after I worked and all, I'd go and take instructions on a 50 caliber machine gun from a Marine sergeant.
Just for kicks?
For future.
You knew you might need that skill.
Yeah, they did too. Yeah, but I didn't use it. I used most of mine in moving the 3-inch anti-aircraft guns, sandbagging them, because if you got bombed today with a 3-inch, they take pictures, and we have to move the guns every day and sandbag them. So that was quite a chore, and we had a lot of casualties.
As you got closer to December, did you have an idea that something might be happening any day now? Were you on the alert?
Yeah, well, we were ourselves mentally, but we couldn't get nothing out of our officers. The Marine Major Devereaux, Marines wasn't there very long. 1st Marine Defense Battalion, And then had a few Navy guys there to take care of the ships and the submarines that stopped by. We knew something was going to go on, and we'd hear rumors about spotting Jap subs out there and different things. So we were pretty optimistic, but we felt that we could knock them over pretty fast. So we was optimistic, very optimistic.
And sometimes reality doesn't necessarily meet with expectations. So tell me about when you realized that it was happening right now.
Well, Honolulu, it was hit at 7:57 in the morning. We were hit 4 hours later at 11, but we was across the international dayline of December the 8th for us, December the 7th on the other side.
But did you hear about what happened at Pearl Harbor before the Japanese hit you?
Well, we heard a few hours before, but we figured we'd have some help. And then we had a Pan American Airways plane in the lagoon, and it took off for Guam or the Philippines. And then pretty soon, half hour or not, they come back and let the gas out and landed. And wasn't long after that, all hell broke loose. Japs come in from the sun, and they wasn't very high, and they dropped their loads and so forth. And we had 12 fighter planes there, and I think 8 of them were hit. The pilots were in there, too.
And where were you, and how did you witness all this?
Peel Island. We were building a bomb-proof powerhouse. We were just getting ready to get on the truck to go to the mess hall on Wake to eat. And then that's when all hell broke loose.
And for those who aren't familiar with the layout, tell us where Peel Island is in relation to Wake.
We had a bridge there, about 100 meters bridge, that brought Wake with Peel. Then on the other side was Wilkes Island. But they were building a passage for the submarines to come in. So those people had to go by boat across the little channel there to go to Wilkes. But they seen a lot of action, too.
So you think you're taking a lunch break, and all of a sudden you're at war.
Yeah, all hell broke loose. And then we was all confused, and I never did hear what Mr. Teeter said, but I was told that the guys at the camp on Wake by the mess halls, and of course I was on the other island, he told them that everybody was on their own and go out in the brush, and if they needed people, they would come and get them, which they didn't. So I don't know. There was a lot of confusion among our people, too, the brains and so forth.
So what was going through your mind? You're 20 years old. You're halfway around the world from any kind of family or anybody that you have a real good relationship with, and now all of a sudden you're on your own against the Japanese.
Well, it was trying to overcome the shock. I tell you, that first day, that night, that was all held. Really shocked, you know, and all. But I leveled out since afterwards, and I volunteered a lot for different things. And in the end, they was going to hold back 300 men. There was 1,165 of our guys. I think around 300 Marines, 68 Navy, 6 Army with a Captain Wilson. They had the communications between the gun positions and so forth. They asked for volunteers. They needed 300 men to stay with the Marines, and I volunteered to stay. But the guy was over me, our Superintendent Iron and everything, he and I didn't hit it off, and we had a few words. And he said, I had a meeting today with the officers, and your name's on there to stay. And I said, I got one better on you. I already volunteered.
Why did you volunteer?
At my age, if I went back to States, I'd been inducted into some force. And I don't know where I end up. I may not even come out alive. So it's just one of those facts in life that you have to say yes or no to and don't have much time to think.
And I think your situation is different from a lot of the veterans that I talked to, because a lot of them were about what your age was at the time. They're 18, 19, 20, but everyone they're serving with is the same age. You had gone over with these contractors, and as you said, a lot of them were older than you. So you have guys twice your age, 40s, 50s, that are fighting next to you, huh?
They were experienced men in their trades and so forth, and being bad times in the country here, a lot of them went over and got made good pay, money, and had good conditions. I was fortunate enough to be in the barracks with some journeymen iron workers and carpenters and so forth, and I had one particular iron worker foreman spend sometimes the evening teach me how to read the plans and so forth, and I carried on the rest of my life doing that.
But for a while, you didn't know if there was going to be a rest of your life. After you volunteered to fight the Japanese there, what kinds of things did you do? Were you on a gun? What were you doing?
No, moving 3-inch guns mostly, anti-aircraft guns. And then when you move the guns, you got to sandbag them. You got to protect them. And you got to have protection for the men because they are not right on the gun all the time. They're away, and then you have jobs of carrying the ammunition, and that's a full-time job too.
And you got to make sure you don't get hit by the incoming either, right?
You got to be careful, and we suffered a lot of casualties, and I don't know. I was pretty fortunate. The second day we had hit awful hard. We was on Peel. We just moved some guns from one end of Peel to another end, and we got hit during the day at noon. I was covered with blood. I was evidently knocked out a little bit, and I was laying on a guy, and he says, "You're hit." Couldn't feel nothing. I looked over there, and he had a big hole in his back. And I said, "Ernie, you're the one that's hit." Then he panicked a little bit. And then to the right of me, about 6 or 8 feet, there's another guy, and he had a bullet right through his head. We had a lot of people around us that was killed or wounded. All we had, we just did what we could to help one another and get along. But the hospital was on the wake right across the lagoon, and it was hit. And they needed help bad. Me and the sergeant, Marine Sergeant Ken Marvin from Gig Harbor, Washington, we went over there. I don't know how in the hell, and he was hit in the head and had a rip in his head, piece of metal there. And we went over there, and a lot of bodies, pieces of body, leg, arm, what have you.
You described this, seeing your friends wounded, seeing your friends killed, seeing pieces of bodies lying left and right. It doesn't sound very encouraging for your own prospects. How did you get through? What did you focus on to get yourself through the next day, the next hour, the next minute?
We had a routine of moving guns, and we had to furnish our own food. We had to find out where the catches were and bring them into our dugouts. And I happened to know where a few of them were, and I had a couple guys, older journeyman iron workers, go with me. I drove the truck because them Jap bombers and the Zeros that come in. And so I hit a pretty good place, loaded up with canned milk and fish and meat and whatever. So we had a lot of stuff.
You talked about going with Marvin to the hospital. What were the extent of your injuries?
Well, most of mine was my head. I was falling down, dizzy, and bleeding quite a bit from mouth and nose, but I did. Well, I had coral hits on me. Coral, the wake is all coral.
Yeah.
And coral is bad as shrapnel.
So a bomb hits the coral sprays everywhere and cuts you to pieces.
And I had a few of those on me and this and that, but after you're so long and you got so much going through your mind, you don't feel a lot of stuff, you know, until you settle down and get your marbles back. And then you go look for some medic or somebody can help you a little bit.
So did you stay in the hospital, or did they put you back out there?
No, the hospital was blown, gone. So we had some facilities there we built, concrete bomb shelters and stuff to store ammunition. They used those for hospitals, and they had some underground stuff we dug out with our equipment, heavy equipment, and they used them for hospitals. And we only had two doctors there. We had a doctor with us and a Navy doctor. But we had a lot of medics on our side, and then the Marines had some corpsmen. There's a big difference between a medic and a corpsman. You never want to call a medic a corpsman.
They don't like that very much.
No, because they probably 5 or 6 years becoming one, and a medic might just be 6 or 8 weeks, you know. So anyway, they did a good job taking care of people.
And at the time, you don't know how long this is going to last. You don't know if you're going to win or lose.
We heard, this is all scuttlebutt, this is what we heard from Marines, there was a force coming in from the Hawaiian Islands. It was bringing more airplanes, more Marines, more equipment, more everything. And the admiral in charge of it, I forgot his name, is Pew or Pooh or something like that. He bought 400 or 500 miles away, and he backed out.
That's Admiral Pye, who had a couple carriers, Saratoga and Lexington, headed toward Wake, but called them off because he thought that they might sail into a trap. Some others, like Admiral Bull Halsey, thought that was a big mistake.
He was pretty well teed off at this other guy because he figured that, and he was right. If they come in when that guy could have, they could have brought more reinforcements, got more help, and maybe we could have held off the Japs a little longer.
So you guys ended up, like those on Bataan and Corregidor, as prisoners of the Japanese. But how did that happen? When did you realize that your side was not going to win this battle on Wake Island.
I never did give it that thought. I always figured we'd be evacuated or there'd be more troops come in, more help, you know. December the 8th, we was hit. December the 23rd, we gave in. And we knew around 22nd or 23rd that it was getting close because they said, boy, the ships will be here in 24 hours or something. It never would show up. So after a while, you just gave up on it.
And I'm sure you never had contemplated spending Christmas as a prisoner of war.
They took us to the airport, all of us. They had machine guns around us and all, and we thought, well, this is it, you know. And we wasn't in too good a shape. I wasn't, in a way, and a lot of other guys worse than me. What we were told later, that the Japanese got orders from Tokyo to not to kill us. So then on Christmas Day, 24th or 25th, we all marched to our camp, the good camp that we lived, but it was the barracks and everything. It was hit pretty hard and all, but you could still go in and seek shelter, you know, from the sun and rain and so forth. And that's where we went, and then we went on detail. Japs had us go on details because they wanted to know where those Oki guns were. Oki means big in Japanese. Well, the biggest guns we had is a 5-inch. We told them none, but we went different places and found different things. We found a lot of our dead guys that crawled back in their holes and died. They were wounded, you know. And after a while, in the heat and everything, a man kind of smells a little bit. Mm-hmm. Boy, I tell you, it's terrible. Stink. But the Japs got the bodies and theirs, and the way I was told that they took them over by the landing part over the inside of the airport. They put the bodies on his bodies, bodies on his bodies, bodies on his bodies, bodies. They burned them and used oil and what have you and burned them all.
Did it ever strike you that that could have been your fate?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You give it a lot of thought. You did a lot of thinking.
I know what happened to you from there. You were a prisoner of war until the end of the war, from the start of the war to the end of the war. If you had known that then, if someone had told you you were going to be held captive for nearly 4 years from that point, would you have believed that you could make it that long in those conditions?
No, I didn't even give it any thought.
Because you have no idea. I mean, this could go on. You could be never get out of a POW situation.
Our mentality was different. We just seemed to be full of cement. Just solidified our head was and everything. Hell, and then some of them kind of went a little nutty. And so it takes all kinds of people.
And I know you ended up in four different prisoner of war camps at the hands of the Japanese, and I know there are a lot of stories you can share from that, and I want to hear a few of them, but I'm curious, when you look at that in the big picture, when you look of surviving 44 months as a prisoner of war with very little to eat, not always treated very well, what did you think about that kept you believing you could still have a life after this? Because a lot of guys, as you said, it made them go nuts. They didn't survive. You made it through. Why was that? What was your key?
Attitude. Oh, gosh, I used to joke with the Japanese. We met some good Japanese that didn't have to be good to us. We'd tell them all kinds of stories. They asked me if I was married, and I said, yeah. And waifu, I got two waifus. And another Jap, a few days later, asked me about it, and a waifu, and I said, yeah. Three or four, I tell them different stories. And one, if I had any kids, and I said, yeah. So one time, about three or four of those Jap soldiers come over there, and ones I talked to at different times in a week or 2 week time, they looked at me and everything, shook their head and said, dummy done, nah, he's crazier than hell.
Finally figured you out, huh?
Yeah, but we, sense of humor. That's what I feel that kept me alive. I kept going. And I was a pretty good thief, too.
What'd you steal?
Whatever was available, whatever we could get, you know.
For your own survival.
Oh, yeah. I was getting around the Japs where they was cooking or something. We'd try to get something, you know, out of it. And then we'd big deal. Tobacco, cigarettes was one of the biggest barter rates there was. And we were only given, what, 5 cigarettes a month. I didn't smoke, so I used to use it for food or money.
Kind of nice when what you don't want can buy you a lot of what you do want. I still can't imagine what it must have been like, but we'll explore that more when we come back. We're celebrating Christmas tomorrow. Our guest, Joe Goikuchiya, spent 4 Christmases in a row as a prisoner of war. Oh, what we take for granted. Back with the rest of Hometown Heroes next, right here on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Christmas Eve. I encourage you to go to KMJNow.com for more information on our guest today, 90-year-old Joe Goycochea, who was on Wake Island when World War II began for America, was captured 2 weeks later, and remained a prisoner until the end of the war. That's 44 months in captivity, four straight Christmases as a POW. Did you ever think about your family and the possibility that you might never see them again?
Many a time, yeah. I prayed a lot. I'm a pretty Christian. I mean, I always did pray. I was taught to pray, and now I did pray. And I feel that's the reason I'm here.
What do you pray in a situation like that?
Gosh, it's hard to tell you. You're praying for yourself, that's for sure.
Get me out of here?
Save me and this and that. And oh, you were scared of being wounded, seriously. That was it, because we had no way. We had two doctors there and the medics, but the hospital was blown up. Everything was taken out to take care of them. They had really no way to really take care of the wounded soldiers, or wounded people, I should say. God, some of them are in bad shape. A lot of them lost a leg or an arm or something.
Four different camps and 44 months as a prisoner. What would you say was the hardest thing to endure? I'm sure you didn't have very good things to eat. I'm sure you lost a lot of weight. But what was the most challenging or most threatening experience that you faced?
Well, so much. In the first year, we was in China, the prison camp there at Wusong. It was cold, icy. We had no clothes. Our feet, gee whiz, just almost cry with the pain in your feet and stuff. And it was miserable. And they gave us two blankets, each prison. You could put the blankets and see through them. Two of you get together. You put a blanket underneath on the deck, wooden deck, and then you put the others over you. Never take your clothes off. If you had any other clothes, you put them all on. But that was the first winter in China, at Wusong. Then after we was there quite a while, we were moved to another camp, at Kangwon. That was a good camp. We fared better, got better feed. We got Red Cross boxes. And then we had a detachment, a bunch of our Marines come down from North China with embassy guards from Pekin, Tientsin, and Qingwentao. And they come with full gear, everything. And they, I think the three doctors come with them. So we got quite a bit more help that way. But we had a Japanese doctor there named Dr. Shindo. He was a wonderful guy. He did everything he could, but he had nothing to do anything with, you know. But he was a peach of a guy. We even sent him money years later from here. Collected money, several thousand dollars, because they have, socialized medicine there or something in Japan. We sent them money over there.
A bunch of you ex-prisoners of war?
Wake on a bunch from Boise here or whatever. The reason we Boise, because most of the men came out of this area. But a lot of the guys that we had were from the CCC camps, Civilian Conservation Corps, you know. Mm-hmm. They came from Carolinas, Virginia, New York, all over the country. Wonderful guys.
Now, I've heard accounts from other prisoners of war that were held by the Japanese of them being personally tortured or seeing other prisoners tortured. Were you ever mistreated at all?
Oh, beaten around a little bit. And I didn't necessarily have to do anything wrong mistake. If you was six of you on a detail and one of them screwed up, they punished all of you. And they usually like to whack you on the side of the head with the rifle butt or whatever they had, you know. I had my share, and I seen some of them really get worked over. And they take the belts off, and the garrison belts, heavy belts with the buckles, they hit the metal end on the side of the face and cut, and oh, heck, they give them a good going over. The ears would be knocked down and so forth.
Were there ever days where you really thought, this is going to be it? I'm not going to make it through this day?
Well, I did when B-29 started bombing. We got hit. That was in Japan.
You're in two camps in China, and then they moved you to Japan.
And the third camp, that'd be the first camp in Japan. And that was one of the largest steel mills in Japan. That's where we were at. But when we got there, there was other American prisoners there, and they were from the Philippines. And they come, some of them, the Death March and Corregidor and Mindanao and Cebu. And we looked like heavyweights compared to them. But it wasn't long, we looked just like them. And then when Tokyo was wiped out, I think in March or April, right after President Roosevelt died. He died in March of...
April 13th, 45.
Yeah, April. And the Japs, they're happier than hell. We'd be marching, he says, Tojo Ichiban, number one. Roosevelt Toban, he's dog rubber. So I'd reverse it, and goddamn, he'd be chasing me around there. But we got hit awful hard when Tokyo was wiped out. I seen quite a few 29s get knocked out of the air, too. I don't know, with the planes or with ACT fire, you know, artillery fire.
So you thought you might die at the hands of American bombers.
Yeah, our own bombers. And so you never know. But I had one leg in bad shape, gangrene and everything. And I didn't want to go to the Jap hospital because the guys that went there and came back advised me not to go because he said, they used to be working on some of the prisoners in their backs and everything. He said, hell, they'd be howling like a mad dog sometime with pain and everything. But when I went to Maury camp, that was a good camp.
This was the last camp that you went, and this is where you were liberated.
Yeah, cruiser San Juan coming to a landing force on us. That's where I met Major Pappy Boynton and Colonel Okanoff and Submarine Tang and a lot of different officers and stuff, and it was all mixture of people. We had a lot of Dutch there, a lot of Eurasians that were captured in East Indies, a lot of British in Hong Kong and Singapore. And then when we go into details, I was only Yankee, little Yonk, they call me, with the British. But God, I got along good with them.
I'm guessing you were probably the only Basque guy there, too.
There, but not in China. There were several of us there then. Yeah, I want to tell you a story one time. These Japs come up to me and wondered my mom and papa what they were. I don't know why, maybe I look different than the rest of them. I said, Basque, Wakadanai. That means I don't understand. I said, mom and papa, yeah, Basque. They come from Spain. Oh, I saw, Espanol.
Of all that time, I'm sure you ate some things you never imagined eating before the war. What would you say was the strangest or most horrific thing that you actually ate?
They fed us everything, you know. We had an American fellow there from Detroit. He worked in a shoe shop, mending shoes for the Japs and stuff, you know. So he had me go there and help him. So he was a pretty sharp guy, nice guy. He was an ironwork, structural steel worker. He told that Jap mess sergeant about a cat. They had a cat running on there, fatter than hell. And he said, that cat's crazy, bugger. This and that, and you had to eat it. My God, one day they took and killed that cat and ate it, but it never brought none back to me. But he said it was real good.
Have you figured out how much weight you lost from...
When I went from the third prison camp, Kawasaki, to Omori camp, I weighed 90 pounds. Then after I was in Omori camp, I went up to 130 pounds. That's how good we fed better and ate better and everything.
And what were you when you left Boise for Wake Island?
Oh, I was around 155, 60. See, I'm only 5'6" tall, and I did pretty well. I was always in pretty good shape.
Well, I want to get to that moment that I'm sure you haven't forgotten, even though it's 66 years ago. Finally, after all this uncertainty, never knowing if you're ever going to get out of captivity, if you're ever going to be free again, freedom comes. Tell me about how you were liberated and what that felt like for you.
Well, when the B-29s were coming in there and bombing, oh, hell, thousands of them, you know. And they just unload, level everything out, hair, guts, and all. When I went to Maury camp, I figured, we're going to come out of this and going to be all right, see? Mm-hmm. Which we were. And then they threw their landing force on us, the cruiser San Juan. They put a picket around us so the Japs could. And then the Japs, they went into the barracks and shut down so they couldn't interfere. So we were free then. Then our planes come over and start dropping food on us, parachutes. And that was almost as bad as the bombs, because they had those big containers, you know, 55-gallon drums. Some of those would break loose and come right through. We never stayed in the barracks. I got the hell out of the barracks because they come right through. And we had several guys get hurt pretty bad. And then when they hit the ground, the stuff would scatter, you know.
You weren't about to survive almost 4 years and get killed by falling food, huh?
Yeah. So we had a lot of guys, fighter planes, come over our camp. They went up and put POW on the camp, painted it up. And they come over and flip-flop and wave, you know.
They tilted their wings at you to say that they saw you.
Yeah, they knew. And so it worked out real good, yeah. And then the carriers that bombed us was the Shangri-La and the Yorktown, I think, the two carriers. When they took us, I went on a hospital ship, Benevolence, and I was there a short time. The leg was real bad, and my body was just eaten up with fleas and lice and bed bugs, like everybody. That was terrible. The doctors looked around me and they said, geez, Wiz, they got bed bugs and fleas there. So I said, the whole god darn country is full of it. And then they put me on LST, and they had cots down there, temporary hospital. I was there for a while, and then they moved me into another ship, a destroyer escort, the Goslin. God, I got aboard that, and they really treated me good. But hell, it's all officers. Some of the guys from my camp, the head officers. Yeah, I didn't want to be around those guys. No. So I was there for a while, and pretty soon they shipped me back to Tokyo, to the Atsugi Airport. I had a number. You know, everything by a number. Nihaku Gojo Hachi, 258.
That was your prisoner of war number.
One of them, yeah. I had so many of them. But anyway, they called my number and everything, and I went out, and there's a C-54 plane, Red Cross plane, and all female nurses, our nurses. God, you smell that perfume, and your neck is swelled up. Oh, God, he's good. And that one gal was looking after me, and I wouldn't tell her nothing. She knew I was in bad shape, and she couldn't figure it out. And they landed in Okinawa. We got out, and I said, where's the Red Cross? She said, there's the first aid station, the Red Cross, and you can get donuts and coffee and everything. I said, I want the first aid. She said, what? Went there, and next thing I knew, I must have passed out or something because I was in an ambulance. And I got to a hospital. It was along the beach, all canvas. It was made up with our people, you know, doctors. And I remember three doctors around me, and they took care of me. This captain, this one doctor, Captain Giroux from Texas. God, he was good to me. And they started giving me shots, and it was penicillin. It's new. I get shot every 6 hours in the rear end. Boy, I tell you, I still feel them. Yeah, you know, our medics are not gentlemen, you know.
I'm sure afterwards you were able to talk to your family and get their perspective on all this. And when you did that, what did you hear from your folks about what they knew this whole time? Because you've been a prisoner for almost 4 years.
I didn't talk to my folks till we got to San Francisco. That's when I talked to my sister and them. And, you know, we talked for an hour or two about everything.
What was that like to set your feet back on terra firma in America again?
Terrific. Terrific. Gee whiz. No end to it. Mm-hmm. The freedom we had and the way we was treated so good, too. And then they give us a big chunk of money and we could go buy stuff and so forth.
Did you ever get a sense of what it was like for your parents, for your family, while you were a prisoner?
They had it damn rough. Yeah, all the people in the States did.
After being free again, knowing what it's like to not have your freedom, is that something that impacted the way you lived the rest of your life, not taking that for granted anymore?
Yeah, it changed a lot of ways, gave me a lot of thinking about staying with what I was doing, work, you know, and getting interested. I couldn't get myself interested in going to college. Had the opportunities and all, but some of them did. Some of them did real well.
Well, I've got to ask you, you had gone overseas to Wake. You had never joined the military. But when you are liberated and you come back home to the States, not only do they end up giving you a Purple Heart, they say, hey, you're a Navy man now, and you've got a discharge from the Navy on your wall. What did that mean to you for our government to recognize what you'd been through that way?
It made me feel real good, because I felt that I did as much as the Marines did on the island. See, You don't have to fire a gun to do anything all the time, you know. And you don't have to get hit by a bullet or shrapnel. You can get concussions or the ground stuff, the rocks and all that coming at you, you know. So felt real good. Made us feel like we accomplished something, you know.
And speaking of good feelings, as we bring this to a close, I need to ask you about something that just happened a couple weeks ago here in Veterans Memorial Park in Boise, right next to the Remember Pearl Harbor Monument in the park there. There's a new monument, and it honors those who are on Wake Island, including you. This 15-year-old Eagle Scout made it his mission to get this done. What did that mean to you to have that monument there and to know that it was a kid who could have been your great-grandson doing that?
I thought it was terrific. I figured that young fella was 110% American, and he had the right ideas. But that made me real feel good. When we came home, they was going to set up a Wake Island monument over by St. Luke's Hospital, but didn't fall through. A lot of our guys, we had a lot of suicides too. We had quite a few guys take their lives. And some of them, the married ones, come home and the wives were jungled up with somebody. And the kids were in the orphanage, put away. And one good friend of mine, his third day after he came home, his wife had a baby. And there's a lot of heartbreaking deals like that. Sure. Me being single and everything, I had nothing to worry about. I come home to a good family, mother and dad and sisters. My brother had just come from England. He was B-24 bombers in the 8th Air Force, and everything went nice, you know.
Looking back now, what would you say you're most thankful for? With everything that you've been through and everything you've been able to experience since you got back, what are you most thankful for?
Gosh, so many things. I don't know, just one thing. I think surviving that second day on Wake when we had so many casualties on the bombing. And I was knocked out, but the guys around me, some were dead and holes in and bleeding. But I felt very lucky that I come out as well as I did.
And I guess you got some kids and grandkids who wouldn't be here if you didn't, huh?
That's right. They're all around the walls and stuff, yeah.
Well, on behalf of all the folks listening to the program, I just want to thank you for serving our country. I know it wasn't your idea to begin with, but you sure did it when we called on you. And I want to thank you for that and for sharing some of those stories with us.
Well, yes, you could go on. I could talk about things that we'd done.
Well, maybe on my next visit to Boise, we'll get Volume 2 from Joe Goicoechea. I know we just scratched the surface, but what a treat to meet a man with such unique experiences. Think about that for a moment. 44 months as a prisoner of war, and he wasn't even in the military to begin with. And how refreshing to learn the story of this young man, Noah Barnes, and how he's honoring the legacy of his great-grandfather and all those other brave Americans on Wake Island. 70 years ago today, those men woke up as prisoners for the first time. Go to KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to learn more about Wake Island and that special Boise connection. Remember, if there's a hero in your hometown you think I ought to catch up with, let me know. Paul@KMJNow.com. It is such a privilege to bring you this program each Saturday. Remember, now we're on AM and FM, Saturday afternoons at 1 on News Talk 580 and Saturday evenings at 5 o'clock on FM 105.9. You can also access episodes on demand at KMJNow.com. My friend George Markley at the Wyndham in Fresno shared a great idea. He said, if we all got one extra present to give to a veteran we know, it would make it a super special Christmas for those who've served our country. So if that resonates with you, try it. And if that veteran happens to be from the World War II era, here's a good gift idea for you. Next Saturday afternoon at 2, that's New Year's Eve, at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Theater, it's Bob and Bing, The Road to Clovis. The best Hope and Crosby impersonators you'll find anywhere have a special performance for us. Tickets are $25. Proceeds benefit the Central California Veterans Home Support Foundation. You cannot go wrong there. Here's the number to call for tickets, 559-797-8155. That's 559-797-8155. Thanks so much for listening. Please have yourself a Merry Christmas and be back here next week at the same time for the final 2011 installment of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.